Greater sense of urgency for a ceasefire deal after 6 hostages were murdered in Gaza.
Some of them we can still save. Maybe Hamas will say no to everything. Maybe. But it's still the onus is on us to do everything that we can to try.
The U.S. says it's still working to bridge the remaining sticking points of a proposed deal.
We believe that these differences can be resolved. And what the next step looks like in terms of resolving them, I think we just don't know right now.
And amid the obstacles of the war zone in Gaza, the next phase of polio vaccinations resumes.
It's very cute because they're actually dressing up to come and get vaccinated in some cases because it's considered, you know, a pretty special event.
Today is Saturday, September 7th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Surrounded by rubble and destruction, a temporary distraction for children in Gaza's Khan Yunis, thanks to humanitarian volunteers who entertained them with song and dance Thursday on the sidelines of the polio vaccination campaign. UN Senior Coordinator for Humanitarian Affairs and Reconstruction for Gaza, Sigrid Kog, visited a clinic in central Gaza.
At this center today, it gives a happy feeling in an overall catastrophic situation. You see people proud to be here, protecting their children, giving the vaccinations. And at the end of the day, it shows when there is political will, a lot is possible on the humanitarian front. That's what we need. This is a prime time example of that.
Despite the challenges, health workers resumed vaccinating children against polio in the southern Gaza Strip early Friday for the second phase of this massive campaign. I spoke with Dr. Naina Bala, medical team lead for MSF, Doctors Without Borders, in Khan Yunis. What can you tell us about how things are going?
It's amazing that it's happening, but it has been pretty frantic in the planning to try and get it done and work within the constraints of what the Israeli military and government is willing to offer us. So it started in the central zone in Deir Bala last week, and it was 3 days with 1 day of catch-up. We started here in the southern zone, which includes Khan Yunis and Rafah, which is the more heavily populated area, and then we'll move to North Gaza. We have been told that they were able to negotiate 3 days plus 1 day of catch-up, despite the request of 5+2, which was the original plan. We've had to change the planning because of the fact of decreasing it to 3 days and having to arrange the staffing and increase the Ministry of Health and WHO have increased the number of mobile teams. And then they agreed to a humanitarian pause, but only for 9 hours from 6 a.m. until 2 p.m. And that's only per zone.
So far, the efforts that you've been able to conduct, has that been relatively safe? What are you seeing as far as the children that you're able to vaccinate? How are they doing?
So it was in the central zone where MSF has supporting, and it has 2 PHCCs. And in the central zone, as the WHO reported, they were able to vaccinate in the span of the 4 days, 187,000 children, which was above the target of 157,000 children. So considering the constraints that we have and the difficulties, we're still able to, fortunately, at least in the first phase, reach our target. Here in the southern zone, yesterday on the first day, 161,000 children were vaccinated, although this area has a higher target population. The target, I believe, is over 300,000 children because it's more dense and it's more populated. And what we have seen thus far is incredible efforts made by the WHO, UNICEF, and the Ministry of Health is providing most of the vaccination teams. And the children that are coming, pretty much the Palestinians are believers in vaccination. Before the conflict started, the vaccination rate was over 99%, which is better than some developed countries. So most people, most families are bringing their children, and it's very cute because they're actually dressing up to come and get vaccinated in some cases because it's considered, you know, a pretty special event. But there are still concerns in terms of logistics. You know, we have some issues with vaccines arriving at centers on time just because of the logistical constraints that there are. And as well, you know, limitation of cold chains. There not being as many distribution centers for the vaccine as we would like. The lack of roads and infrastructure to transport the vaccination teams and the vaccines, and then just, you know, general security for the healthcare workers, ourselves, and the families to be able to bring their children. There still are concerns about this.
In the areas that you are working in and that you're able to get around, can you tell us a little bit about the overall situation on the ground?
So in terms of the campaign, you know, I think there is this reported humanitarian pause that the IDF has agreed to, the Israeli Defense Forces and the Israeli government has agreed to. In reality, one thing that needs to be remembered is that this is per zone, and it's only from 6 a.m. until 2 p.m. So this means that in the evenings, in the mornings, before we wake up, that there is no pause. And so this can still affect, you know, healthcare workers' abilities to come and perform their tasks in the vaccination campaign and show up for it. It also can affect the families' abilities to bring their children to show up for the vaccine, to get their, to give their children the vaccine. Just after the vaccination campaign in the central region was completed, before we started here on Thursday, early on Thursday morning at 3 a.m., there was a targeted airstrike in the central zone just hours after the humanitarian pause ended and just hours before it was supposed to start here in the southern zone, that killed 5 people and injured close to 20 people. Just last night at 11:30, so again, just hours before in the zone that we are performing the vaccine campaign, there was a targeted strike close to one of our guest houses, and that also injured multiple people and killed 4 people. So the fighting and the military action has not stopped. It is quieter during the day between the hours of 6 a.m. and 2 p.m., but there still continues to be fighting. And, you know, obviously this is a population that has already gone through more than 10 months of this, constantly having to evacuate and relocate. And so, you know, their ability to feel comfortable moving around because of this reported humanitarian pause, I don't think is significantly different than it was 1 or 2 weeks ago when there wasn't this pause.
Can you just describe what it's like there on the ground, what you're dealing with as far as infrastructure and the people, any sort of light you can bring to what you're physically seeing on the ground around you?
I have been here for about 4 weeks, and just the amount of overcrowdedness that has happened over the span of the past 2 to 3 weeks is extremely impressive. The number of evacuations and kind of the shrinking of this humanitarian zone continues to happen. More than 80% of the whole Gazan population is being pushed into a space that's about 11% of Gaza, and the humanitarian zone continues to shrink. There have been evacuations and fighting in areas that are deemed to be part of the humanitarian zone. And, you know, there's roads that continue to get smaller. So every day, every week, we're trying to see which roads and which ways are able to, are safe to take, that are able to. There used to be at least 1 to 2 roads that could be accessed to move from the south to the central region when I first arrived. And then because of increased evacuations and fighting in Deir Hawala, it basically shrunk to only having one road that was available for all movement, walking, you know, bikes and cars to be able to access within the humanitarian zone from the southern area to the southern zone to the central region. And so the number of cases that we're seeing in our clinics, but also being reported by WHO, of skin infections is about 50% and continues to be the case. There, we still have issues getting basic supplies into Gaza. We generally usually have infection control is a big part of what we're doing in any of our missions and working especially in hospitals. We don't have access to soap. Don't have access to soap in our wards or to give our patients on a regular basis. We have to ration the liquid soap that we have available amongst the whole hospital and then within our wards and prioritize where we're going to use soap in different areas of the hospital than others. The people are traumatized, and this is not just the patients. This is also the healthcare workers that have continued to show up for work every day for over the past 10 months and are suffering the same losses of loved ones, continued evacuations, inability to access their family, or sometimes inability to move to work because of security. They continue to show up. And I think for myself, I can say that I think it doesn't matter who I speak to, at least on a daily basis, whether it's a patient, whether it's a staff member, whether it's our driver. I think I probably speak to at least somebody every day that tells me a story that brings me to tears, because the amount of devastation and the amount of loss here is, it's unimaginable.
And I would imagine it's going to take a long time psychologically, no matter what happens, for people to emotionally recover. And
yeah, I think everybody is still in survival mode here, you know, and to do that for 10, 11 months, going on 1 year, to be in survival mode for that amount of time, to not have even really processed the losses that they've suffered, the number of people that are injured, the number of people that will have permanent disabilities after this, not to mention the wounds that we can't see. You know, at our hospital, we have a burn unit that we're helping to run in the Ministry of Health Hospital. Some of the children are there with domestic burns, but it's because they're living in areas where they have to have open fires and, you know, their overcrowdedness. And some of the children are there because of explosive burn injuries, but they are traumatized to the point where, you know, we have one child that for the first 2 weeks he was in the ward didn't speak at all. And another child that we saw, we have many children that they're so traumatized to when they have to go to get a dressing change to hear their screams. It's tough.
Yeah.
And this has become like the regular, you know, it's funny. I was talking to somebody today that works at a field hospital that we visited, and the medical community here had started to kind of put on a scale when we have mass casualty incidents now. So if it's only 20 or 40 people that are coming, we call it a smaller, medium mass casualty. I mean, normally a mass casualty is something that in itself should be a definition of something huge and tragic. But because it's a part of the daily life here within hospitals and the emergency departments, we now say, oh, it was a small one, it was a medium one, or it was a very large one. But because they happen on a daily basis here.
Well, thank you for bringing to light some of this. Appreciate your taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Naina Bala, medical team lead for Doctors Without Borders in Khan Yunis. The UN says the humanitarian situation in Gaza is beyond catastrophic, with more than 1 million Palestinians not receiving any food rations in August. You are listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Hamas is believed to still be holding more than 100 hostages. Israeli authorities estimate about a third of them are dead, including the six captives shot to death this week. A Sabbath ceremony at Hostages Square in Tel Aviv Friday called for the return of those still being held. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have taken to the streets in the past week, calling for a deal and saying time is running out to bring home the hostages still alive. The Israeli government has been under increasing pressure from families of hostages, as well as the United States and other allies. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insists on a demand for continued Israeli control of a narrow band along Gaza's border with Egypt, where Israel contends Hamas smuggles weapons into Gaza.
Somebody has to be there that they can actually prevent the recurrence of what happened there before. Murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. So it's not going to happen.
U.S. National Security spokesman John Kirby, speaking to reporters Thursday, repeated the U.S. position that the only disagreements on implementing details of a proposal need to be hammered out between Israel and Hamas.
Our communication with our Israeli counterparts continue, and we still believe that though this is incredibly difficult, that we can, in fact, if there's compromise, if there's leadership, that we can still get there.
Joining us from Israel for a deeper look into the stalemate and public sentiment is Shira Efron. policy advisor at the Israel Policy Forum.
First of all, I mean, this has been a difficult week for Israelis and around the world, but we have to remember it's another week in 11 months that have been absolutely hell for the families of obviously hostages, the internally displaced people in Israel, the hundreds of thousands of people around here, but also obviously for 2 million people in Gaza, right? And there's a whole region that's tittering on the brink of a war. And I think this is an important context of what we are talking about right now, because there's the tactical question. Is it Philadelphia? How many IDF troops stay or do they stay and when do they leave and where do they go from? And if you recall, there was also a demand on the Netzarim corridor, which bifurcates Gaza from north and between north and south. There are always the tactical questions. And then there's this big strategic question. Most of the Israeli public believes that the hostages that are in Gaza because of Hamas, the reason that they're in Gaza is Hamas brutality and barbarism and the fact that they were taken there and the fact many of them are dead now is also because of Hamas. But the Israeli public would like to believe that at least the Israeli side is doing everything in its power to bring the hostages back home, those who are alive, to bring them home to recovery, and those who are dead, to bring them to, you know, burial and mourning and allowing their families to pick up the brakes and continue with their lives. And the question of Philadelphia or Netzarim or the perimeter or when the IDF goes in is perceived as an attempt to derail the negotiations. Because, and this is something I've heard from also U.S. officials, Israel does in the closed rooms, Israel does accept the proposals. But then outside in the media, you have primarily the prime minister goes out and say, well, yes, but... And the but comes with conditions that are legitimate. You know, it is legitimate that Israel would be very concerned about smuggling of arms and dual-use materials that would let Hamas rearm. But we're not in a perfect world. And is legitimate condition, what way do we assign to this question when it comes relatively to the lives of the hostages, to the ceasefire in this war, to the need to de-escalate tensions in the north so the Israeli IDPs can go back home, to the need to focus on what's happening in the West Bank and in Iran and calming down all the other seven fronts that Israel's fighting in, right? So this is a moral question, it's a security question, and it's a diplomatic question. And that's why the tactical question and there's the strategic question, and I'm afraid we constantly talk about the tactical questions, but not about the strategic one. The strategic one, do we end it? Do we want to bring those people home? Are we doing everything that we can as Israelis? Hamas may say no, but are we doing everything that we can as Israelis to bring them home? And according to also reports in the New York Times, but it's also very much the sentiment here in Israel that the current government of Israel is not negotiating in good faith with this big idea in mind.
Hamas is threatening to kill more hostages. I would imagine that it would hurt them too, because then they wouldn't have anything to bargain. But at the same time, they've obviously shown that they have no problem killing innocent people and flaunting it. It would seem like now more than ever, the remaining hostages that are alive are in some serious danger. But at the same time, I would imagine that it's sort of a conundrum for the government to not step up a ceasefire because they've killed hostages and because it would look as if they're placating. Is that accurate?
This is definitely a rationale that some advocate here. I have never had any expectations of Hamas. It's a cruel, barbaric terrorist organization. What they did on October 7th showed good illustration of that to Israel and the rest of the world, but it was never a legitimate actor. And that's why I don't have any expectations from Hamas. We can only control, you know, the Israeli side. Now, if Israel wants to go and penalize Hamas for what they did, yes, of course, but Hamas has been doing this to Israel for many, many years now. The issue needs to be, you know, how do we bring those hostages back home? And then if Israel wants to restore deterrence, don't do it on the back of the poor, who knows how many people still alive are in Gaza, right, in terms of the Israeli hostages. So it is a valid argument that we need to toughen up. But the fact is, because we know what Hamas is, we know that the only way to bring those people home is through an agreement. Sure, we can be lucky and fortunate and maybe rescue one or two, although you mentioned it yourself, Hamas said we're going to kill more hostages. So I think we have more military operations to try to rescue hostages are now going to risk the hostages' life, which is what happened, unfortunately, last week. So, you know, this is not a perfect world. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible tragedy. And we're left with bad options all around. But if the priority of the Israeli government, and this is also a Jewish value, right, Pidyon Shvuim, is the, if the moral thing to do is to bring whoever we can home and try to put this country back on recovery. So this is sort of the moral argument. There's a security argument because we do want to de-escalate tensions everywhere in the region and maybe prepare the IDF for the wars that it might have to engage in later on. And there's also a diplomatic argument to this. Israel is part of the international community. So we constantly hear from the Israeli government at the moment all the risks of a ceasefire now and not ending the war. And I'm asking, can we compare these to the risks of never ending this war?
Well, it sounds like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is determined to completely eliminate Hamas.
We can't eliminate a movement, an idea. What the IDF has done in the past 11 months is it has eliminated Hamas's ability to govern Gaza and to commit terror attacks on Israelis. Is there a risk that Hamas may regrow and rearm? Sure, we need to handle this risk in the first stage of humanitarian deal, which will be 6 weeks, so 42 days. Hamas will not rearm. Hamas will not be able to rebuild tunnels. This is the first stage, right, of the deal. And it gives Israel more time to prepare and work with partners. And, you know, the partners are there. The U.S. is there. The rest of the international community is there. You need Egypt, which is, by the way, diplomatic ties with Egypt are deteriorating day by day because they see Israeli presence on the Gazan side of Philadelphia in the long run as a violation of the peace treaty with Egypt. And it is a violation. As an Israeli living here, I would like to try to secure the border between Gaza and Egypt with the help of the Egyptians, not to alienate them in this process. There are a lot of considerations. This is not a perfect world. There are tough decisions to be made, and it's difficult, and trying to be completely apolitical here, it is difficult to see how the benefits and the priorities here reflect genuinely the interests of the country and not the interests of the prime minister and his coalition partners.
What is the overall mood there?
Israel is an interesting place because there's so much resilience, right? So if you look in the parts central of the country where most people, I'm going to be cautious about it, where most people are back to their normal lives, the mood is, you know, overall people, everyone says, you know, nationally and my mood is terrible, but on the personal level, thank God I'm fine. Unless you are related to a hostage family, you have a son or daughter or a family member who is injured from the war or displaced or is serving now in Gaza, the West Bank, the Northern Front, or wherever. And these are a lot of Israelis. Then if you go around the country, I mean, Israel is such a tiny country, but it shrunk even more, right? After October 7, what happened is that with the displacement in the north and displacement in the south by Gaza, you basically have a lot of people, more than 100,000, that have been living in hotels, have no homes, have no schools for their children. So there's a lot of frustration and sadness and you know, we're still kind of not even the post-trauma of October 7. There's still a lot of people living the trauma. And first and foremost are obviously those the families of the hostages in Gaza, who some of them we can still save. And maybe Hamas will say no to everything. Maybe. But it's still the onus is on us to do everything that we can to try.
Shira Efron, policy advisor at the Israel Policy Forum. In another tense part of the region, a 26-year-old American woman was shot and killed in the West Bank on Friday. Witnesses reported that the woman was shot by Israeli troops while attending a demonstration against settlement expansion in the northern West Bank. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.